This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. The U.S. is in the middle of two public health crises. One is, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, which continues to drag on despite several vaccine options. But according to the CDC, deaths from drug overdoses rose to a record 93,000 last year, and roughly three-fourths of those deaths involved opioids. Isolation, disruption of addiction services, and other consequences of the pandemic are being blamed in part for the overdose surge. At the same time, a $26 billion settlement between states and some of the biggest companies in the opioid industry is being finalized, but not every state is on board. We'll talk about the details of the deal a bit later, but first, let's talk about how we got to where we are. Joining us now is Regina LaBelle, Acting Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Regina, thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us and for discussing this topic.
So currently you work in the Biden White House, but you had a similar position in the Obama administration. The epidemic hasn't gone anywhere and has only gotten worse. Why do you think the U.S. still hasn't gotten a grasp on how to recover?
So I think one of the most important things to remember about this issue is that overdose deaths have actually been going up since the 70s. And what we're our approach to this, it was and has been for the last several years, is addressing addiction as a chronic condition rather than an acute condition, which means that it's not a crisis that's going to go away. It's something that's going to be with us for some time. And we're actually finally approaching it from in the right science-based way to make sure we get the help to people who need it and prevent substance use from ever occurring.
Has it also included a switch from treating addiction as a criminal issue and treating it from a public health perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important part of what we're doing. And, you know, as the president has said, no one should be incarcerated for drug use alone. And unfortunately, for too many years, that's been our default strategy, is to incarcerate someone for public inebriation, to incarcerate someone who may be publicly, inebriated again. So we are, but finally, beginning in January 2017, finally, the U.S. government started putting additional funds on top of the ACA, on top of Medicaid, to address this issue. And so we're finally starting to look at this as a chronic condition.
So this is a national issue. What kind of national strategy do you see working?
So we have put in April, we sent to the Hill our policy priorities for this issue. And they begin with prevention. And by prevention, we're talking about looking at the social determinants of health, the root causes of what may be driving substance use to begin with. Secondly, getting people the type of treatment that works, that's effective, and evidence-based. Thirdly, for the first time in the nation's history of the history of the Office of National Drug Control Strategy, we're embracing and advancing harm reduction. And by harm reduction, we're talking about syringe services programs, naloxone, making sure that people who, we meet people where they are, we don't leave them there. And then recovery supports, which means that, again, treating addiction as a chronic condition. And then last but not least, also disrupting drug trafficking networks. And because we have a global supply of drugs that come into this country, and it's important, they're criminal enterprises, it's important that we disrupt those drug trafficking networks as well.
When you talk about the harm reduction part of your strategy, how heavy of a lift is it to get support for those types of strategies? Because so often, because of the stigma attached to addiction, people are resistant to support anything that they think supports addiction.
Right. Again, the premise of harm reduction is to meet people where they are. And I try to meet people where they are on all sides of the aisle on this issue. Because if you really talk to them about it, I don't think anyone, there is no one in this country who has been in touch with someone who uses substances that doesn't understand that we need to treat them with compassion. And that's what harm reduction is. So I think, again, if we start, you know, we started several years ago with the Obama administration by having naloxone distributed through law enforcement. That changed a lot of attitudes among law enforcement when they were saving lives by providing naloxone to people. And I really believe we can do the same thing if we talk to people about how harm reduction services can help the majority of people in this country who aren't in treatment, but still need services, still need help to keep them healthy and to guide them into treatment.
Regina, why do you think we saw such an uptick in drug overdose deaths over the last year?
So there are still, researchers are still looking at exactly what happened. We have a couple assumptions we're making. And, you know, there was a disruption in services. We know that. We saw early on in the pandemic, harm reduction services closed. We saw an increase in isolation. More people may have been using alone. They didn't necessarily have access to naloxone, the opioid overdose, the drug that can reverse overdoses. And also there was a disruption in the drug supply. We saw an increase in certain substances in illicit fentanyl getting mixed in with other drugs. So it's not just one issue, it's a multitude of issues that we saw. I think it's also important to note that drug overdose rates were going up prior to the pandemic, but they were accelerated during the pandemic.
How have we seen the opioid epidemic impact communities differently?
So as we, you know, when I first started talking about this issue, the average person who was overdosing was a 45-year-old white male from the Appalachian region of the country. We have seen overdoses go up across the country in every demographic group. That's why one of our priorities is also addressing racial equity. One startling fact to me is it takes 4 to 5 years longer for a Black person with a substance use disorder to enter treatment than a white person. And that's controlling for socioeconomic conditions. So we have a lot of catching up to do and a lot of work to do to make sure that access to prevention, treatment, recovery services are equitable in this country. We are not there yet.
How do you think our healthcare system as a whole can work more effectively to both prevent and address addiction and overdose deaths, especially with the understanding that not everyone has access to, say, a primary care physician?
Right. So there's two ways. One is making sure that that education in medical schools, healthcare providers get the type of education that they need in order to recognize a substance use disorder. So again, for general practitioners, that would be just making sure that they know the early warning signs. But also at healthcare clinics around the country, federally qualified healthcare, to make sure they have substance use disorder practitioners there. So one of the issues we're working on is our workforce issues, educated workforce issues, to educate the workforce. And then the second piece that could address this is just equity. And that's parity through our health insurance and through Medicaid, to make sure that we have a law that isn't necessarily always enforced, to make sure that substance use disorder treatment is treated the same as any other physical condition. And that's done, again, through Medicaid, Medicare, as well as private health insurance.
That's Regina LaBelle. She's the acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Regina, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, a closer look at the state hardest hit by the epidemic.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Audible. Chasing Ghislaine is a new investigative podcast series from executive producer James Patterson and hosted by veteran journalist Vicky Ward, who has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for nearly 20 years. Epstein's story intertwines with the disgraced heiress Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's ex-lover, former employee, and alleged co-conspirator. Chasing Ghislaine is available exclusively on Audible. To start listening, go to audible.com/chasing.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Let's get back to our conversation about the opioid crisis during the pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic has worsened the opioid crisis in the U.S. Last year, overdose deaths rose 29% over 2019, but some states have been hit harder than others. Here to talk about it is Chris McGrill, author of American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. He's also a reporter at The Guardian. Chris, welcome back.
Good morning.
Also with us, Matthew Christensen, Director of the Office of Drug Control Policy at West Virginia's Department of Health and Human Resources. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Kaylee McLeod, Director at the Philadelphia Coalition on Children and Opioids and an Addiction Policy Analyst. She's also in long-term recovery herself and has been sober for over 9 years. Kaylee, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Chris, we heard the Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy on this, but talk a bit more about why 2020 was such a devastating year for opioids and overdose deaths.
Well, it was partly, as Regina LaBelle mentioned, lack of access to treatment. People who had been who had been receiving treatment face to face in some places were no longer able to do that. It was hard for them, for many of them, to get the kind of support that they required. You see, with the rise in unemployment, with the economic conditions created by COVID-19, the return of, you know, some of the pressures, societal pressures that contribute to addiction. And I've spoken to both people who have struggled with addiction and those who've been helping them, say, over the past year, there was a real sense of isolation, and that's a big contributor to drug addiction amongst some people, and a sense of there was nobody out there for them. There was no, not only access to services, but the necessary human contact that helps people deal with addiction, the human support services.
How big of a role does fentanyl play in overdose deaths, or are we seeing a bigger issue right now?
Well, we're seeing something, you know, evolve. I mean, Regina LaBelle, in spelling out the origins of this crisis, failed to mention the one big factor that makes this a largely American epidemic, which is, of course, the role of the drug companies in pushing prescription pills, prescription opioids, which open the door to access to these drugs. Over time, that evolved from prescription pills to much greater use of heroin as the cartels started to realize there was a fresh market in opioids. And that, in turn, opened the door to fentanyl. Now fentanyl is playing a very important role in that, partly because it's a very hard drug to judge. If you know about heroin or you are using prescription pills, you can see how much of the opioid you're using. With fentanyl, of course, because it's so powerful and because often it's hidden. It's bled into heroin, it's used in fake prescription pills. People don't know how much they're using. And then there are people now who are taking the risk and just using it on its own. So it's become a big part of driving deaths up. I mean, so much so that now fentanyl is found it's the single largest determined drug in those deaths, although fentanyl is also often found with other drugs such as heroin.
Matt, you're in West Virginia, the state hardest hit by the opioid epidemic. What has the past year been like where you are?
West Virginia has had a really tough year in the past year. You know, but prior to 2020, we had been making significant investments in our addiction infrastructure in 2018 and 2019. We began to see some of those effects, the effects of that investment pay off, and the public health approach was clearly working. We saw a reduction in overdoses. We saw more recovery beds, more treatment beds, more points of access for addiction treatment. But 2020 clearly put us back. No one would have thought before this pandemic that a virus would be the thing that would bring us to our heels and profoundly affect our addiction landscape in this way. You know, we identified that this was going to be an issue very early on. We have some early reporting systems that use EMS data and emergency department data to look at warning signs around overdose, and began to ramp up our response and implement programs, app-based programs, so that people could get treatment remotely, increased our capacity for telemedicine, instituted protocols for bed spacing and treatment programs, pushed out naloxone, and were very aggressive in responding as well as we could during in the middle of an unknown landscape with regards to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Kaylee, Philadelphia was one of the cities hardest hit by opioids, even more so during the pandemic. And Kensington, that's a neighborhood in Philadelphia, has been called the Walmart of heroin. What have you been seeing in the city?
Sure. So thanks very much. Thanks very much for that question. And before I get started on that, one of the things that I really want to send acknowledgement to and bring up, especially with respect to Philadelphia, is the effects of the crack epidemic and sort of the way that the war on drugs really set the stage for what we're seeing now. So in addition to sort of these opioid overdose numbers and these fatal overdoses, what we're also seeing is the effects of poverty, of child welfare involvement, of gun violence, and all this unrelated trauma. And I say that to introduce sort of the demographics of what's happening in Philadelphia, which is we had 1,214 fatal overdoses in Philadelphia last year, which is 9% higher than our 2019 high. And I definitely want to point out that of those numbers, there was a 31% increase among Black residents, while there was a 9% decrease among non-Hispanic white residents. And I think Michelle, that's a really great question when we talk about Kensington and sort of being known as the Walmart of heroin and this open air drug market. I think that's the perception of what's happening in Philadelphia, and to an extent that is very, very true. But I want to be clear that these opioid overdoses and overdose related deaths are happening throughout Philadelphia, right? They're happening in West Philadelphia, they're happening in my neighborhood in Germantown. And one of the things that can be really scary about that is that in sort of these lesser known or sort of lesser identified areas, a lot of these overdoses can be happening behind closed doors and in isolation, whereas in an area like Kensington, where you're sort of more likely to see some of this drug use in public places, there's actually more people around and you're more likely to be, your overdose is more likely to be reversed.
Matt, how are you approaching treatment right now?
So through a few different mechanisms, you know, we all want and demand and need results right now. But as Director Lavelle mentioned, you know, we have to remember this is a marathon, not a sprint. This is a chronic disease that once someone has opioid use disorder or stimulant use disorder, that this is something that they're going to deal with for a very, very long time. As COVID-19 presented these challenges to our treatment landscape, we did institute some recommendations for cleaning protocols, for bed restrictions, for intake restrictions. Those have, for the most part, been lifted. We need to look at this through two different mechanisms. One are the immediate actions that we have to continue to take, which is saving lives and supporting individuals to get into treatment on demand when they're ready, ensuring they have access to services, ensuring they have supportive recovery communities so that there are people there to accept them when they're ready to give recovery a try. But we also have to look at the big picture. And that big picture goes back to prevention, goes back to addressing equity issues, adverse childhood experiences, and opportunities for economic advancement and development in a way that we really haven't looked at in the past.
Kaylee, Matt, I want to hear from both of you about ideally what the balance is where you live, what you'd like to see in terms of program, whether it's harm reduction or it's more treatment services or more focus on prevention. Kaylee, I'll come to you first and then Matt.
Great. Thank you. Thanks so much for that question. So I think really in order to answer that question, there's a few questions that we need to ask ourselves. So I think that on a cerebral level, we really need to talk about the idea of availability versus accessibility. So I think it's one thing to have, you know, treatment centers that are available and open and ready to take people. But what we happen to see in Philadelphia and also across the country is underutilization of those services. So to me, that means that people who need these services or might want these services or people that we decide need to be consumers of these services are not finding these services accessible. And I think that the answer to that question really sort of lies in our inability so far at a policy level to really include people with lived experience and people who use drugs in sort of making these decisions. So my short answer is to ask people who use drugs what they need. And then again, I think at the policy level, we really need to really think about what our goals are to figure out what the best treatment options are, whether that's harm reduction, prevention, or treatment. And I think there's very different answers, whether the goal is one, to stop people from using drugs, or number two, to save lives, which I don't think are necessarily mutually exclusive. I think on a more general level, there are some really fantastic community organizations community-based organizations in Philadelphia. PHMC, my organization, has quite a few of them. There's also NET Centers and Prevention Point. And I think that also there's some really great new models like the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics where we can really make sure that treatment and prevention and whatever services we're providing are community-based.
Matt, what about for you?
Yeah, just to echo a point that that Kelly made about incorporating individuals with lived experience, I think that's such a crucial piece to make here. If you know, we could lay the best made plans at the state level and the policy level. If they don't resonate with people on the ground who are trying to help, then those are going to go nowhere. And so we really have to focus on the individuals that we're trying to impact. You know, with regards to the treatment and recovery side, we've looked into and continue to support the idea that when someone's ready to get into treatment, they should have the opportunity to do so. And so that involves working with emergency departments, working with primary care clinics, working with harm reduction programs to build consistent linkages into care so that those individuals have access to evidence-based care at the drop of a hat and on a consistent basis. The thing that we have struggled with and the thing that we really need to continue to work on is true prevention, which looks at, you know, from the school environment all the way up through 20s and even 30s, looking at mental health resiliency, looking at ways to build capacity amongst our teachers and other supportive agencies in the schools to make sure that we are supporting kids and addressing adverse childhood experiences.
Well, and briefly, what are some of the trends you're seeing in West Virginia in terms of how or what drugs are being used? We've been focused on opioids, but what else are you seeing?
So as 2020 progressed, it became very clear that we were seeing a different makeup of drug. As Chris McGreal mentioned, the prevalence of fentanyl has increased significantly and fentanyl relating to overdoses increased, as has the potency and lethality of methamphetamine, two drugs which cause significant social and societal impairment and things that we still need to focus on.
We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. This is 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
We're talking about the opioid crisis in the time of the pandemic. Chris, let's get into this $26 billion opioid settlement. How significant is this?
It is very important to the extent that it's a recognition by three of the countries, or the country's three biggest drug distributors, which are probably not household names, but actually extremely large multinational companies, and then Johnson & Johnson, which manufactured opioids. There's no admission of responsibility, but what there is this $26 billion, as you say, which a number of states have been very hesitant about this deal originally because they felt that it wasn't enough and that they should be getting more. But they've signed up to it because the money will start to flow relatively quickly. That said, West Virginia has opted out. In part, it's the state with the highest overdose rate in the country, and it has had that for some time. And West Virginia says that this deal disadvantages them because the money is distributed according to state population size rather than the impact of the opioid epidemic. But it is, even if it's not a formal acknowledgement, it's a practical acknowledgement of the part played by an element of the drug industry. I mean, this is mostly the distributors and then one manufacturer. There are other elements of the drug industry. There's the other manufacturers, and there's also the pharmaceutical, the pharmacies that also played a role.
Well, here's a question we got from someone in St. Louis. Let's listen.
My concern is all of these companies that are being sued for the opioid crisis, and yet where does that money go to? Just the state gets it? Because what about the people that were directly affected, like myself, my family, the thousands of dollars I spent on treatment? Why does the state get that money?
Chris, have we heard from any states who want to put some of this money directly into the pockets of those who were affected?
No, this deal it doesn't go to the individuals. It's a very good question, actually. Individuals are not seeing this money. It goes to the states. But there was a lesson learned from the tobacco settlement, the $200+ billion tobacco settlement of a couple of decades ago, where states took that money and didn't use it to offset the effects of smoking. They use it to balance budget and build schools and things. Written into this is very specific commitment by the states and municipalities that are suing. It's not just states, it's also, there's basically nearly 3,000 lawsuits that involve municipalities, cities, counties, that money will go to some very specific aims that have to do with the impact of the opioid epidemic, everything from treatment through to the care of children who've been affected, babies born in withdrawal. So that's where the money's going. But the states, the municipalities do get to decide. It doesn't go to the individuals.
Matt, as Chris said, West Virginia's attorney general is rejecting the settlement. Some counties and towns in the state are already in the middle of a trial with opioid companies. What do you think West Virginia deserves and needs as it tries to recover?
West Virginia has been disproportionately impacted by the opioid epidemic with regards to the number of opioid prescription pills that have come into the state, and then the multi-generational impacts of the subsequent heroin and now fentanyl and methamphetamine phases of the addiction crisis. And so West Virginia needs, again, this is a chronic condition. This is a marathon and not a sprint. So West Virginia needs long-term sustainable funding. The short-term recovery packages that have been distributed to the states are very, very helpful. Lots and lots of lives will be saved. But West Virginia needs long-term support in order to address this in a meaningful way.
Chris, you recently spoke to families who've been affected by the epidemic, and many said they feel the settlement is a way for these companies to buy themselves out of accountability. Explain more of what you heard.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that a lot of these families are looking for is a form of justice. A bit like big tobacco and smoking, they feel that the drug industry has spent a lot of time denying what it knew about addiction and how it pushed drugs, opioids into American homes in a way that really didn't happen in any other country. I mean, the trial we were talking about in West Virginia, there's three distributors on trial there that sold more than 1 billion pills in that state over a period of a decade. No other country was there prescribing at that level. And the families say it's all very well for them to pay, these companies to pay these settlements, but they really treat it as a tax write-off and the cost of doing business. And they want to see the executives who made the decisions that, in essence, broke the law. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that a number of these companies have actually pleaded guilty either to criminal charges, like Purdue Pharma, to federal criminal charges, or alternatively, they've paid fines to settle federal actions by the DEA and others over their actions. And what those families want to do is see the executives who made those decisions to flood this country with opioid prescriptions individually held to account.
We've been talking to Chris McGrill, author of American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, and a reporter at The Guardian, Matthew Christensen, director of the Office of Drug Control Policy at West Virginia's Department of Health and Human Services, and Kaylee McLeod, director at the Philadelphia Coalition on Children and Opioids and an addiction policy analyst. Thanks to you all for being here today. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.